Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin spoke last weekend at the first ever Tea Party convention. It was a gathering of anti-Obama, anti-government activists who've expressed deep dissatisfaction with leaders of both parties. Here to talk about the movement, its potential political impact, Brendan Steinhauser. He's director for federal and state campaigns for Freedom Works. Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform, joining us from a studio at WBEZ in Chicago. Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and joining us from a studio at NPR in New York, John Avlon, senior political columnist for The Daily Beast. We are going to take your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we begin our conversation with our guests here in the studio, we'll talk with Judson Phillips, who joins us from Nashville. He was the organizer of the National Tea Party Convention. Good morning, Judson. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Indeed. Tell me about the goals of the Tea Party Convention and what you actually think was accomplished.
Sure. Well, we had three basic goals coming into this convention. We wanted to get people together, activists from across the country who didn't know each other, so they could get to know each other, network with each other, exchange ideas. We wanted to give people, education, information, to teach them how to do things that they may not have figured out how to do yet or how they could do certain things better. And finally, this movement started a year ago, and you know, I can tell you, I don't really know anybody who does this full time. I don't. I've got a job. I've got a family. And I do what I'm doing on the side. And that's the story of most everybody in this Tea Party movement. And the final thing we wanted to do is just do an event that would give them some real encouragement and pump them up so that they're ready to go out and face 2010, which I think we can all agree 2010 is going to be a very interesting political year.
I do agree that 2010 is going to be a very interesting political year. I'd like to go back to your second point, that is in regard to education. What kind of educating are you doing?
Well, we were teaching people how to do things. Excuse me, I apologize. We were teaching people how to do things like organization at the precinct level, how to do voter registration drives, how to use technology to assist you in achieving your goals. See, the amazing thing about the Tea Party movement, it's average everyday people who have never done anything like this before. I've got to tell you, the best moment for me at the convention was during one of our, we did a forum on the future of the Tea Party movement, and I asked people, there were 600 or probably over 600 people in that room, I said, how many of y'all, but prior to the Tea Party movement, had ever been involved in politics? About 98% of the people held up their hand. Now think about that for a second. Of these people, this movement started a year ago, and these folks paid to come here, and they are motivated enough, and 98% of them had never been involved in politics before. That's absolutely amazing.
Judson, there was a little controversy about the fact that they did have to pay to come to the convention. Why was that?
Well, it's very simple. We set this up. We are not a Tea Party Nation, which is the group that I run, is not a nonprofit group. My vision for Tea Party Nation has always been we would use the capitalist system to generate the revenues to advance our goals. If you go to a broadcasting convention, for example, you have to pay for it. Go to CPAC, which is actually run by a nonprofit, you've got to pay for it. Somebody had to pay for the infrastructure that we needed for this, the hotel, the convention facilities. We fed people, and to be honest, we fed them pretty good. Every meal was taken care of, so they didn't have to worry about all that. And guess what? That costs money. So, and in fact, everybody who was at the convention, one of the common themes that they had was not only was the convention incredible, but they couldn't believe what we did for what we charged.
It's interesting because one of the objections you have to the current government is that taxes are too high. You're going to have to pay taxes on that convention, aren't you?
Yeah, that's the law. That's one of the things when we set this up, we're going to have to pay taxes on it. In fact, we've got our paperwork at the accountants now to figure out what, if any, tax liability we have. Of course, we do have to make a profit in order to have a tax liability, but I'm pleased to say our profit was in the high two figures.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Tell me where the movement goes from here.
All right. It's very obvious this movement has an end game, 2010 and 2012. 2010, we've got to elect a conservative Congress, conservative House, conservative Senate. And I think that's going to happen because of the public outrage and just the general discontent. We also have to get more people, more conservatives involved in the political process. We need to get these people running for office. We need to get these people into the political organizations. For example, I advocate Tea Party people going into the Republican Party and taking over the Republican Party. In 2011, we have got to set the stage for the 2012 election because, as we all know, if you're involved in politics, the election doesn't really occur in 2012. It occurs in 2011. The voting just takes place in 2012.
When you say you'd like to see the Tea Party movement take over the Republican Party, what have you got against the Republican Party?
Well, other than they've abandoned the principles of Ronald Reagan and conservatism, not a whole lot.
You think they've totally abandoned the principles of Ronald Reagan and the Conservative Party?
And for the most part, when we have the Republican establishment under Michael Steele endorsing and pushing candidates like Dee Dee Skaza-Faza, who is more liberal than her Democratic opponent, when we have the Republican establishment pushing a candidate like Mark Kirk, who was one of eight congressmen who crossed the line to vote for cap and trade with the Democrats, yeah, they've pretty much given up on the conservatives. We as conservatives, and at least this is my opinion, I think we've got a real problem because every 2 years they come to us, they expect us to carry the water for them, they expect us to hold the signs up, go out and be the field army for the Republican Party, and then as soon as they get back up to Washington, they completely forget about us and ignore us until the next election. And you know what? We're tired of it.
Tell me what Sarah Palin represents for the Tea Party movement.
Sarah Palin was the first major political figure to come out and directly talk to the Tea Party movement. We had contacted a number of people about coming out. In fact, one of the things we wanted to do at the convention, I wanted to have a dialogue between the two major parties and the Tea Party movement. We invited Michael Steele to come, and I called the DNC to try and get in touch with someone so I could send the invitation to Tim Kaine. The DNC would not even return our phone calls. Michael Steele had a, quote, scheduling conflict, and I will give them credit. They did talk to us, but I guess he felt being in Hawaii was just a little bit more important than coming and talking to the Tea Party convention.
So I'm back to Sarah Palin. What does she represent to the movement?
For one thing, she represents someone who is listening to us, and that, if I had to express the one underlying theme of the Tea Party movement, we talk about the specific issues, but what really has motivated people in the Tea Party movement is the fact government doesn't listen to us. And so that is the huge frustration of the Tea Party movement, that we are out there in large numbers telling the government, we don't want you to be doing these things. We don't want you to do cap and trade. We don't want socialist health care. We don't want our taxes hiked, et cetera. The government's not listening to us. Sarah Palin came down, listened to us, talked to us. She's shown the movement respect, which a lot of other politicians have not shown. And so that's one of the things that she means to the Tea Party movement. Now, if I can correct you on one thing.
Sure.
At the intro, you called her the de facto leader. This movement has no leader. And Governor Palin, in her speech about three or four times on Saturday night, said, I am not the leader of this movement. She is not. I'm not the leader of this movement. Brendan Steinhauser, my friend who I think is in studio with
me,
is not the leader of this movement. This movement has no leader, and that's kind of the amazing thing about it. It's a leaderless movement. Now, at some point, I will say this. This movement is going to coalesce around someone, because our end game is winning the White House in 2012, putting a conservative in the White House. So this movement, by consensus, is going to coalesce around someone that we're going to push to put in the White House. Now, is that going to be Sarah Palin? I have no idea. I can't speak for anybody other than myself. I just don't know the answer to that. But that is our end game, and it is going to happen. And that person, I'm not calling them the leader of the Tea Party movement. Standard bearer might be a better word for it.
All right. I take your point. If you're speaking just for yourself, would you like to see Sarah Palin as that candidate in 2012 for the Tea Party movement?
Sarah Palin is an intriguing prospect. You know, I had the chance to sit down and talk with her a little bit one-on-one, and then I had the chance to do the Q&A with her. I like her in a lot of ways, and I think she's very interesting. Is she going to be the person I support 2 years from now? I don't know the answer to that, because as we all know, 2 years is an eternity in politics. You know, 2 years from now, we will have done the Iowa caucuses, and I think we may have done the New Hampshire primary by then. And even then, that won't be too far into the election process of that year. So it's really hard to say at this point who I will be behind.
No, even an inkling that you might be behind Sarah Palin?
Well, I'll put it this way. If we're having the presidential election today, based on the warm bodies that are out there that have, or at least talked about as a prospect, if the election were today, yeah, I'd be behind Sarah Palin.
Judson Phillips, he organized the National Tea Party Convention. He spoke to us from Nashville. And we're back to talk about the recent Tea Party convention, the movement, what they would like to accomplish. You've heard from Judson Phillips, who organized the National Tea Party Convention. I gather there were about 600 people in attendance. Grover Norquist, as someone who is president of Americans for Tax Reform, here's an email for you from Matt. He says, is the ultimate goal of the conservative movement to eliminate Social Security and Medicare? Are they using the Tea Party movement to accomplish this? I'd like to hear Grover Norquist on this.
No, look, what the Tea Party movement is saying is this government in the last year has gone crazy in spending. They threw $780 billion on stimulus, which was supposed to reduce unemployment, and unemployment went up by $2 million. They threw another $350 billion at the banks, which Obama now says he wants to call them names. Yep, after he threw $350 additional billion dollars at them, he can call them any names he wants. The banks are very happy with Obama, Reid, and Pelosi. So what happened, and I've been involved in the taxpayer movement for 30 years, I believed when Reid, Pelosi, and Obama had united left-of-center Democratic government in the United States, in Washington, that it would take several years before they were forced to raise taxes to pay for too much government, and then people would react. What happened, in fact, was the Tea Party movement, 1,000 different rallies around April 15th around the country, and that's a low estimate. It's tough to tell because it is so decentralized and everywhere. They reacted to spend too much and became politically active, and that is a game changer. A lot of us, myself, Obama thought everyone would wait until the tax increases, which is why he wanted to put them after 2010, 2012. You saw Arlen Specter, Republican senator in Pennsylvania, who thought he just won his reelection because he was going to vote conservative on everything, judges and taxes and so on, but he threw the one vote on spending, the stimulus package, and his numbers collapsed. He had to switch parties, and now he's running behind a former congressman for the Senate seat. So spending became a political movement, and the other factor here is that this is made up of independents. What matters is 2006, 2008, independents shifted against Bush and his Republican Party. We shouldn't underestimate Bush's responsibility for these problems. They said, well, we don't want endless war. Now they're switching radically opposed to too much spending. They see an endless spending as threatening as an endless occupation of Iraq.
John Aplon of the Daily Beast, you were at the convention this weekend. Tell us about it.
Well, I think what you saw at the convention is the larger fault lines of the Tea Party movement, which is that at its heart and at its genesis, when these protests first started erupting in February 27th of last year, it is a fiscal conservative protest movement. It is anger at deficits and deficit spending, debt, growth of government. And that part of the movement is still there. These folks feel like Paul Revere is trying to warn their fellow citizens about the costs, the long-term costs of this unsupportable spending and growth of government. The other main strain started emerging over the course of the summer as the movement got more radicalized, as grassroots activists ironically started appropriating by name Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals with much more sort of street theater protests, confrontational tactics, etc. There is a stream of Obama derangement syndrome that runs through many of these folks. And these are the people who hold signs comparing the president to Hitler, comparing to him a communist. Now, it is not the whole movement by any means.
But I gather
it is baked into the cake.
Okay, but you didn't see those kinds of posters at the convention.
No, ironically, at the convention, the dynamics that I'd seen covering the protests was reversed. At the convention, the folks who'd paid to go there were actually comparatively civil when compared to the people who spoke at the movement. So the one of the ironic things was the opening night speaker was Tom Tancredo, former congressman, who called the president a committed socialist ideologue and called for a civic literacy test for voting. The next night speaker was Joseph Farah, the editor-in-chief of WorldNet Daily, who spent most of his speech talking about birther claims. And then Judge Roy Moore spoke, and he talked about how the president hated our heritage and our history, compared him to George III, and raised the specter of forced disarmament and UN troops in America, which is a fear tactic that folks on the far right have been playing since the John Birch Society. So you actually had an audience that was much more civil and constructive by comparison than the speakers.
John Aplon, he's with the Daily Beast. He's the author of the book titled Wingnuts: How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. Brendan Steinhauser, tell us about your organization, FreedomWorks.
Well, FreedomWorks is an organization that goes back to 1984, and we're a grassroots organization that has members in every state in the union. We're up to 400,000, most of whom organize online. And our message is lower taxes, less government, more freedom. And we've been active. We were involved in the original health care debate back in the early 90s as an organization. And then now with the, through the bailouts and through everything the Republicans did in Congress, opposing what President Bush and Tom DeLay and Hank Paulson did to basically destroy the Republican Party, we've carried that on through 2009 and 2010 when the new crop of big government proponents came in. So we've been very active in opposing Republicans and Democrats who try to centralize power in Washington.
I gather you opted not to go to the convention. Why not?
Well, there are a lot of opportunities to do things like that, to speak at events, to co-sponsor things. It was a budgetary decision. It was a priorities decision. And I think that the folks down in Tennessee had it together and organized what they could for the people that could come. But we were focused on a lot of different other things. We had activist training that came in the week before that we were doing, and we've got a lot of different things we're doing in terms of elections this year with our PAC.
So how does your organization fit in with the Tea Party movement?
Well, I would say that our organization was one of the central groups involved in the early beginnings of this movement. We were out there opposing the TARP plan. We had petitions out where 60 to 80,000 people would come in and sign and say, I'm opposed to this. We tried to just sort of rally people around that and say, let's get out there and contact Congress. And then that eventually led to people taking the streets in February.
Brendan Steinhauser, he's director for federal and state campaigns of Freedom Works. Turning to you, Rick Perlstein, taking a look at this Tea Party movement, how does it compare to other movements we've seen in the past through the decades that perhaps have come up with their own agenda, their own ideas?
Well, the continuities are actually astonishing. I mean, I have here in front of me a bunch of printouts of articles from something called the National Indignation Convention in 1961 and 1962. And the guy who led it said, our chairmen are not chairmen of anything. We emphasize the importance of an individual. We have no leaders. You know, we're a grassroots organization. We just sort of popped up. We're not Democrats. We're not Republicans. You know, just like then, now a later investigation always shows plenty of millionaires with vested interests behind the scenes without which the organizing couldn't exist. It's always a game changer. It's always a Democratic president who's leading us to civilizational ruin. And there's always incredulity that people couldn't see that the ordinary folks are ready to take over and lead a revolution. I think the striking thing about it, and it doesn't necessarily speak well of the political media, is every time this happens, every 10 years or so, people act like it's a reinvention of the wheel. So, you know, I get a lot of calls as a historian saying, where's this stuff come from? And 10 years from now, I imagine I'll get the exact same calls and we'll be saying the exact same thing.
Here's a tweet we've received that says, the Tea Party seems to be all sentiment and no meat. Lower taxes and less government than what should be done, not just opposed. Rick Perlstein, is that sort of emblematic of the other movements you've seen in the past?
Very much so. The idea, and this is the sort of apocalyptic thinking that's also kind of baked into the cake on the right, is that we're always on the verge of ruin. We're always spending ourselves into oblivion. And of course, it never happens. And then 10 years later, a Democrat comes in and they do it again. The important point to make right now when it comes to the fiscal question is that we have 10% unemployment. And
9.7 as of last
Friday. And we're going to have 10% unemployment unless we do something about it. America does have a structural debt and deficit problem. But, you know, I have enough confidence in America that we can kind of take care of the problem by spending responsibly in an emergency, and that we don't have to act like the house is on fire and pretend like, again, the apocalypse is just around the corner. And that sort of childish kind of churlishness always leads to bad policy decisions. And,
right.
You know, I see that both on the Tea Party right and a lot of folks in the center in Washington who are, you know, using this as an occasion to say we need spending freezes and deficit commissions and we're in a national emergency. We're always in a national emergency to these people.
Rick Perlstein, he's author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Grover Norquist, you heard earlier our friend Judson Phillips talk about challenging the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party. What sort of opportunities and challenges does the Tea Party pose, especially to the Republican Party?
Look, the Republican Party has seen this before. You have a wave of people who share the values of the Reagan Republican Party, and some of them, as the gentleman said, they look at what George Bush did and said, that's not the Reagan Republican Party. What's going on here? And that's right. However, the the bulk of the structure of the modern Republican Party is the Reagan Republican Party. And you see these new people coming in, Tea Party people becoming politically active. We had this with the Ron Paul movement coming in recently, people who hadn't been affiliated before, full of energy. You had this 20 years ago with the Christian Coalition, people who hadn't been active politically, felt threatened by some of the things Carter was doing, said, what do we do, became active. Watch this end of this week, Friday, the 12th, in North Dakota. There's going to be a 1,000-person rally organized by the Republican Party and the Tea Party activists in North Dakota. So you can have a statewide effort, to bring people together. Nobody works for anybody else, and talk about what's going on in politics. 1,000 people in North Dakota is a huge chunk of the population. The fellow, Gary Emeneth, is putting it together. He's the party chairman. This is the model for both successful Tea Party activists and successful Republicans to work together. Any Republican Party that isn't open to that is heading for failure.
Brendan,
Diane, it's uncanny.
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, I'm just reading this article from 1962 about an organizer bragging about the 4,000 people they gathered in Odessa, Texas. I mean, it's always on the verge of this people's revolution. It's striking.
Okay.
And a little boring, actually.
I want to ask you, Brendan, what kinds of divisions you see between FreedomWorks, the Tea Party, and the Republican Party?
Well, I think first what unites everyone is what we say, you know, fiscal responsibility, basic limited government, which brings in independents, Democrats, and Republicans. So it's not that it is sort of coming from the fringe or coming from just the right. That's the thing that unites people. What people are disagreeing over is to what extent the Tea Party should work with the GOP at the local level, at the national level, to what extent they should be involved in elections as opposed to education, as opposed to building long-term constituencies, people that believe in freedom, that are involved in not only politics but culture, art, music. There's these different strands of this movement. And I actually believe we've left the political phase and we're entering a social movement that is going to be something that takes even Rick Perlstein by surprise.
Brendan Steinhauser, he's director for federal and state campaigns of FreedomWorks, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Rick Perlstein, there was some troubling news about Colorado Springs. Tell us about that situation and its relevance to national issues.
Well, let's set the context. Colorado Springs is a city with many, many military institutions, not least the Air Force Academy. And several evangelical organizations are based there, including Focus on the Family. They have their own zip code out there. So it's basically a place with a profoundly conservative electorate. And it really has become a laboratory about what happens when conservatives are allowed to take the reins of government. And, you know, like Sam Rayburn said about, you know, the 50s, anyone can knock down a barn. And what they've done is they've stripped the city. Now they've had to cut off one-third of the streetlights at night. They've had to lay off police. They're closing parks. Because the idea is that if you raise taxes, or even if you keep taxes at a responsible level, you're taking away people's freedom. You know, another example is, you know, a couple of years ago in Minneapolis when the I-35 bridge collapsed, and then the Minneapolis Star Tribune did an investigation and found out that after Governor Pawlenty vetoed a highway bill that would have, you know, covered some of those repairs, there were documents showing that there were nickel and diming the repairs on bridges like that. So there are consequences. As you know, as conservatives say, ideas have consequences, and the bill is coming due for some of these ideas. It's just not responsible.
John Avalon, did you hear at the convention talk about Medicare and Medicaid?
No, and that was striking to me. Sarah Palin spoke a lot in her speech, which was a real barn burner for the crowd there, but she talked a lot about cutting spending. You know, the notes she had on her hand were interesting because she'd written budget cuts and crossed out budget cut, the word budget, and added tax. And the reason for that is because budget cuts require a degree of specificity. She wants to bring down the deficit and the debt, which is motivating anger among Tea Partiers and many independent voters. But she didn't mention mention entitlement reform. And you cannot bring down the long-term deficit and debt until you deal with entitlement reform. So there is a reluctance among some of the folks who are posturing at the head of this movement to really deal with the heart of the problem. That's when the politicization starts creeping into this. And I think it's important, one very important point here, that Grover was making. It's important to distinguish between the Tea Partiers and independent voters, because there's some overlap on the issue of fiscal responsibility. But fundamentally, the Tea Party movement, as I've seen it and studied it, is a conservative populist movement. They are to the right of the Republican Party. Independent voters consistently tend to be in between Democrats and Republicans, closer to Republicans on economic issues and closer to Democrats on social issues. They are angry at the polarization of Washington. They think Washington is too polarized. The Tea Party movement and conservative populists want the parties to be more polarized. They want the parties to move more to the right, the Republican Party in particular, to move more to the right. So it's important to understand that, you know, independents are the largest and fastest growing segment of the electorate. There is a lot of anger at politics as usual out there, but it is not the same thing as the Tea Party movement. And conflating them is a self-serving mistake, I think, for some folks on the right.
John Atlan of the Daily Beast, Brendan Steinhauser of FreedomWorks, Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Freedom, and Rick Perlstein, author of Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Short break, and then your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
It's been called the most dangerous and most beautiful place on Earth. A journalist from Kashmir recounts the pain of leaving his war-torn country as a boy and the heart-wrenching stories of those he met when he returned. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. It's time for your calls, 800-433-8850, first to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, I met you when you came to Kalamazoo.
Oh, good.
WMU.
Sure.
And my question is, when the crowd applauded when blatant racism was expressed by Tom Pancredo, it reminded me of a Ku Klux Klan meeting. And why would they applaud or even consider him as a speaker if they don't agree with him?
John Ablant, you were there. You heard Tom Tancredo. What was it, he said, of a racist nature?
Well, what the speaker is referring to is he called for a literacy test for voting and used a Hispanic accent in that. What he meant, he clarified later and in the full context, is a civic literacy test. He was implying that Obama voters didn't really know what they were voting for and might have made a different decision if they were educated about this country, which, of course, is a condescending attitude, among others. But the great point that the caller raises is, why begin the convention with Tom Tancredo? The Tea Party movement has been largely silent on the issue of immigration to date, which distinguishes it from a lot of populist anger that sometimes emerges in economic downturns. And Tom Tancredo, former congressman, is known as an anti-illegal immigrant activist. Why they decided to make him the opening night's keynote speaker is a mystery, because all it was going to do is highlight some of the negative stereotypes about the Tea Party movement and therefore restrict the movement's ability to, I think, broaden and move some of its ideas into action. So
all
that,
right.
A lot of the speaker choices would raise real questions about judgment.
Brendan Steinhauser.
Well, first I would say that, you know, the Tea Party Nation can answer why they invited Tom Tancredo to speak. I would not have. I don't think Tom Tancredo has really been on the message that everyone else has been on since last year on the spending and the role of government. But if you look at the March on Washington, which FreedomWorks organized with all the Tea Party groups around the country, when we looked at speakers, we had a very colorful stage. We had 13 or 14 African-American speakers. We had immigrants. We had women, men. It was a very diverse crowd. But it seems like people fail to notice that, fail to take any kind of notice, and then they just go ahead and lambast us and look at one speaker at one event and say, this represents your movement. But those crowds were in the hundreds of thousands, and people cheered just as loudly for African-Americans as any other speaker. So.
All right, let's go to Tony in Geneseo, New York. Good morning. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
I'd just like to remind people that if the Tea Party movement was truly in favor of constitutional principles, they'd be in favor of majority rule, and they'd be against the filibuster. Obama won with 53% of the vote in his first election. Ronald Reagan won with 50% of the vote in his first election. And all President Obama has to do is hit the banks hard for the next couple of months, and all the independents will be on his side. We're not opposed to spending in general as long as it's targeted social spending. I think people got mad at all the money for Wall Street and not for Main Street, and the Democrats just got to get that back in line. The majority is for the public health option, and they're for sensible spending that helps the middle class. That's what I think.
Rick Perlstein.
The caller raises a really good point and says something profound about sort of Barack Obama and how he does politics and how he thinks about the world. It has a lot to do with the space that opened up that allowed this Tea Party movement to get so much attention. People are angry. You know, we are living in a populist movement, and people are angry at bankers, and people are angry at government for not reining them in. And one problem with Barack Obama's way of doing things is he doesn't really do anger. It's not his thing. It's not really his idiom. So if you're angry, if you're mad, there's no place for you in Barack Obama's Democratic Party. You don't hear yourself in his speeches. So it gives the Republicans and the people to the right of the Republicans a kind of political monopoly on the emotion of anger.
All
so
right.
That, you know, I heard a very famous actor who's renowned for being on the left, I heard a rumor that he's starting to give money to the Tea Party movement. And I was like, why is this happening? And I haven't checked it out, so I'm not using his name. But the idea kind of makes sense, because if you think that the establishment is rotten, the people who in the Democratic Party who speak like they're in the establishment, that everything's a technical problem, don't really give you anything to grab onto.
Here's an email for you, Grover. It's from Richard in Charlotte, North Carolina, who says, I don't understand why the Tea Party folks cite Ronald Reagan as epitomizing their objectives, as President Reagan did all the same things for which the Tea Party people now criticize congressional Republicans: irresponsible tax cuts, ballooning deficits, and expanding presidential power. What's the difference? The Tea Party platform seems to harken back to Robert Taft, not Ronald Reagan.
Well, Ronald Reagan is the leader of and the person who symbolizes the modern conservative movement. That's also the modern, largely the modern Republican Party, but as Bush reminds us, not always. So modern conservatives look to Ronald Reagan as their model. And what did he do? He took marginal tax rates from top rate of 70 down to 28. He took the inflation rate from 12% down to 2 to 3%. He brought interest rates down from 21% so that people could buy houses. He turned the economy around. He created millions of jobs, tens of millions of jobs, and broke the back of the Soviet Union at the same time with all the snotty liberals telling him he was doing everything wrong and that everything he did would lead to inflation, high employment, and a resurgent Soviet Union. The left was wrong about everything in Ronald Reagan's presidency.
Hold on just a minute. I take issue with the word snotty. Don't like it. Just wanted you to know that. Secondly,
condescending.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll
use that instead.
Hold on a minute.
What about ballooning deficits under Ronald Reagan? Isn't that also something Tea Partiers don't like?
Too much spending is something both Tea Partiers and general conservatives oppose. And as some of us said during the Reagan years, you have to control the Congress if you're going to control the spending. The president is not enough. And when Congress changes, you have a change in both deficits and in spending. When the Republicans took the House and the Senate in 94 to 2000, you actually had surpluses and slower growth of government.
All right, Rick Perlstein.
Yeah, the condescension issue that you raised, Diane, is really fascinating because this guy, Justin Phillips, was asked why he wasn't, why the local Nashville Tea Party activists couldn't get into the thing because they couldn't afford it if this is such a grassroots movement. And he was actually quoted, I think, in John Avalon's reporting as saying, quote, they wanted to keep the convention elite. And, they're bragging about the steak and lobster that they sold. So it's, you know, a little rich to hear about the condescending, snobby liberals
right,
when it comes to this.
Let's now go to Arlington, Massachusetts. Good morning, Frank. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Diane, I want to point out that prior to 1980, the deficit, the national debt, was less than $1 trillion. And the only and since that time, it has ballooned under Republican administrations. And there was one Democratic administration in that time, that was the Clinton administration, who left a surplus when he left office. And part of the big contribution to this this deficit is two major tax cuts for the wealthy who are probably funding this Tea Party convention.
All right, John Avalon, do you want to comment?
Sure. I think it's important to understand in the macro sense that what a lot of the Tea Partiers are angry about and what overlap accounts for the fact that independence voters began breaking with President Obama last spring in reaction to the stimulus spending and bailout backlash is that independent voters have liked divided government and disliked deficit spending for a long time. They look back at the Clinton-Gingrich era when actually deficits went down as kind of a golden age because there was a checks and balances built in. They tend not to like unified control of government because it tends to lead to ideological arrogance and legislative overreach. And what I think folks on both the far left and far right need to understand that. This is the anger that's out there right now is focused at both big government and big business. It is not a pure populist anger on one side of the aisle or other.
All right.
And I think people are willfully misreading some of the history to fit it into their own narrative.
Let's take a caller in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you so much for having me on. I'm a government teacher at a very high school here in the area, and Grover, I read your stuff all the time on Arena and everywhere else. I read a lot of you guys. So to ask you this question, and specifically to Judkins as well, when you guys have these speakers come on and say these things, I feel it's a great dodge by saying it's a decentralized movement because then you can say, oh, there's no leader. We're just having all these speakers. I don't take responsibility for the speakers when they say things like we need literacy tests. So to kind of go back to that, I would just like a yes and no answer from the panel. Do you support literacy tests as a prerequisite for voting rights in this country?
Brendan Steinhauser.
Of course not.
No.
How about you?
I'll go with a no.
How about
strong
you?
Strong no.
Okay, we've got four no's. Does that satisfy you, James?
I suppose it does, but then I ask myself this: if that's satisfying and what I would expect that any logical person would do, but then the Tea Party movement cheers. Did they cheer it?
And that's true.
Well, 600 people in a room cheered supposedly that comment. So that 600 people that showed up at one event at one time. What I will take responsibility for is, again, the largest Tea Party protest, which was in Washington, where I did have the permit in my name, where FreedomWorks was the organization sponsoring. Go back and look at the speeches on C-SPAN. Those messages, those speakers that we brought up to the stage were people that we agreed with. So certainly if I have some kind of control over a particular event and there are thousands of events going on, I'll take credit for that.
I stood on the side of the road and watched every single person and every single sign all the way down Pennsylvania Avenue. And there wasn't anything that was inappropriate except two Lyndon LaRouche people with signs who were Lyndon LaRouche guys, and Lyndon LaRouche runs as a Democrat. But everything else was perfectly cheerful and acceptable.
Right, and this is the same thing that they say every decade, too, that we're just ordinary Americans, that I don't see any bigots. And then, you know, the liberals, you know, come out with their showing, Barack Obama with a bone through his nose. John F. Kennedy kissing an African dictator.
Okay, here's an email from Tom, who's in Berwyn Heights, Maryland. He says, the largest discretionary item in the budget is defense spending. The largest line items are Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. These four budget items are the only pieces of significance. Which would the Tea Party elect to eliminate? Brendan.
I think if you ask most people that attend Tea Parties, most people that lead them, they would say across the board cuts of some kind would be good. But really what's motivating these people are the bailouts and the waste of money with the stimulus that did nothing. So we can talk about the budget overall, but really what angers people is the unfairness of the bailouts and the $800 billion in stimulus. That's really what they're focused on. But most of these people would definitely cut spending, defense, any social spending, things like that. But that's sort of second tier. Absolutely.
All right, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Vincent. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I have a question. My wife and I just recently filed our taxes, and we fall in the 15% tax bracket. And when it was all said and done, we only paid 6% of our income in taxes. Now, I understand that doesn't include sales tax and things like that. But the question for your panel is, what do you feel is the appropriate tax level? My wife and I feel that we pay a very small portion of our income for all the return that we get. And I'll take my answers up here.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Grover.
Sure. Six states actually have a line on their state income taxes allowing you, if you feel that you should like to pay more, to do so. Massachusetts, Arkansas, and others. The federal government allows you to send a larger check in as well. I've always been interested to see those people who want to take other people's money and force other people to pay higher taxes, whether they'd like to do that themselves. They have the opportunity to. You write the check in. The government keeps track of these numbers.
And here's an email for Grover from Chris, who says, Diane, you opened with a question to Grover Norquist about the longtime goal of conservatives to abolish Social Security and Medicare. I have not heard an answer.
Oh, well, I think you were quoting somebody as saying that. No, I'm not for abolishing Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. I'm for making them fully funded. Right now they're set up not fully funded, and we need to give people more choices in how they handle their retirement. And I'd like to see us move more towards a defined contribution pensions, which are fully funded and where the government can't cheat you.
Would you
Of course, Grover Norquist wants to get rid of Social Security and Medicare.
No, I don't.
It's his life's
don't tell
work.
Me my position, sir. I've written a book on the subject.
You said that you're a Leninist and that these things are 30-year projects.
We're not name-calling and I'm a Leninist.
On the record.
Hey, wait a minute. Grow up. I'm not a Leninist. I'm an American. Thank
How
you.
Would...
I fought Leninists all my life, okay. And we crushed the Soviet Union. Thank
Grover,
you.
You never said that you had a Lenin as a hero?
Rick,
no.
Hold on. Grover Norquist.
He's lying.
How would... Please don't use such words on this program.
Liberals are allowed to treat people that way.
No,
it's the way
I
they
don't
do.
Think so. I don't think so. And Check remember the words that you used.
I was referring
as well.
To snotty liberals. That's not every liberal. But the ones who are condescending to other people,
it's
yes.
Funny, Grover, I asked you not to use that word, and you went ahead and used it again.
I was clarifying the use.
Okay. I'm asking you how you would fully fund Social Security.
Well, what other countries have done, what China is moving to, what Chile has done, is they've allowed people to start, younger people, to put their FICA taxes into a 401k and allow them to fully fund their Social Security, as a lot of people do in the private sector with their pensions.
What you're saying is you would get the government out of Social Security.
Well, you'd have
heavy individuals do it on their own.
It'd still be a Social Security system. It'd still be mandatory that you, so that when you get to be 65 and retire, there is resources there for you. The system they've structured
the
right now.
The money that you would put in.
Your own
in.
Money that you put in that so would otherwise go into taxes.
So the government would be out of it.
Well, the government would not be holding your money for you. You would be holding your money for you,
okay.
Which I think you can trust yourself better.
I wanted a clarification on that. I'm afraid we're out of time, gentlemen. Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform. His latest book is titled Leave Us Alone, Getting the Government Hands Off Our Money, Our Guns, Our Lives. Rick Perlstein is author of several books, Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. John Avlon is senior political correspondent for The Daily Beast and author of Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. Brendan Steinhauser is with FreedomWorks. Thank you all so much. Sure. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.